Hello and welcome, merhaba ve hoş geldiniz, to the 70th edition of Talking Round North Cyprus, your one-stop shop on what's happening, who it's happening to, and everything else that might concern those who live or visit the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus. And I can't believe this, for the 70th time, let me introduce our man in the TRNC, Roger Burra. Hi, Roger. How are you doing over there in, Paradise Island? You like to call it Paradise, and I don't blame you.
Yes, it's all good here. Hello, everyone. Hello, Sarah. It's still very, very hot and very little happening. There's still people going on about the UN and about how they're useless and how it's got actual relevance to our podcast today. Apart from that, the only thing of note that's happened overnight, very sad actually, is that it appears, according to the police, that a couple in their 30s, the man murdered the wife, put her in the car and then drove it off a 60-foot cliff. And both their bodies have been recovered this morning. So that's just come through literally in the last few minutes. But apart from that and the heat, all good here.
Good. Well, we're holding out, and this weekend it's a big one for Leicester, actually. I'm working at BBC Leicester at the moment, but we have Radio 2 in the park coming to Leicester, which is all quite exciting. That's what's happening sort of my end here. Now, I know we usually chat for a few minutes, Rog, before introducing our special guest, but I know you really want to get on with things today because we indeed do have a very special guest, a former soldier, now an author, and someone, Rog, who took time for you to get together, is that right?
Yes, Sarah. Logistics mainly got in the way. Now, Willie Lint lives way out west in Lapta, and I'm normally right on the east coast. But during my recent extended stay, Lapta way, I didn't miss the opportunity to meet up with Willie and indeed his lovely wife, Lena.
Now, I'm sure that many of you have heard, if not indeed read, about the book Willie's written, Erin Coy, 1964, The Toothless United Nations. Now, I know that this book has had a great effect on you, Rog, hasn't it?
It certainly has. In fact, I've got to say, I found it a very difficult read, not because of the way it was written, just the actual content and what happened in the 60s, according to someone, of course, who was there. Now, many people believe the Cyprus problem began with the intervention of the Turkish armed forces on July the 20th, 1974. But if that's what you believe, you really need to read this book. The inter-ethnic killings and discrimination leading up to that intervention, the Greek Cypriot majority government's attempts to cover up deeds. You know, this goes as far back as 1955 with the start of violence against the British troops and police stationed in what was then, of course, a British Crown colony. Now, the siege of Erin Coy, as described in this book, is only a tiny part of the greater conflict of the time. And yes, it's surprising that even today, a normally balanced Wikipedia fails to mention the presence and active participation of mainland Greek army units in the shelling and the bombardments of poorly equipped Turkish Cypriot villages. Now, all this is in the book, so I won't say any more about that. But when I did get together with Willie, I did ask him, first of all, why did he become a soldier?
To become a soldier was something I was thinking about all the time when I was growing up. I had many relatives with military ranks, Navy and Air Force and armies in Sweden and in foreign countries, and even my ancestors had military background in many cases, so it was quite natural to become an officer in the army. That was my intention.
So you started in 1956?
Yes.
And the first 8 years, is it true to say that you never actually saw any action, so to speak?
That's true. I mean, we were shooting with guns, with machine guns, with cannons, with artillery, with mortars, with tanks, with bazookas, anything. But never anyone who shot back. That was... It's a stupid way of saying, but it was something that came to my mind. How will I react? How will we react when we are in real danger? Not only because it's cold, minus 40 up in northern Sweden or things like that, noisy and so on, but and wet. What would happen when people start shooting at you with the intention of killing you?
8 years after you joined the army,
you got some experience of that. You went to Cyprus. Now, did you offer to go to Cyprus, or were you told to?
What I offered to go to Cyprus. It was a voluntary mission, actually. So I had tried before to go to Africa, to the Congo, where Sweden had UN forces since 1960 already. And I know some people from there. A very good friend of mine had been there. He spoke the local language and so on. So it was his mission. And he even came to Cyprus later. But there was no space for me. So I had to wait another year. And then I came to Cyprus instead.
Why did you come to Cyprus? What was it that attracted you about...
It was actually the place where there were things going on. There was a conflict. Yeah. And why should I go to a place where I go to restaurants, drinking beer, dance with ladies, things like that, when I have a chance or go to a place where something is really happening? Of course, that was what I was intending.
Now, this is really important in the context of people who are going to read your book. What was the UN supposed to be doing in Cyprus? What was its job in 1964?
In 1964, the job was, the UN was supposed to be the peacekeeping forces. And they, to some extent, tried to keep the peace. Relations between the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots was not very good. There was an intention from the Greek side, definitely, to get rid of the Turks of the island, to force them out of the island, either by buying them or forcing them with violence. And the difference, I mean, the UN had about 9,000 soldiers.
And what was your job in the UN?
My job was as a platoon commander. A platoon is something between 35 and 50 soldiers, to be in the area where there were Turkish Cypriots and try to stop fighting when it occurred, mm-hmm. and try to keep people apart as much as possible.
Now, the very first chapter after you get to Cyprus in your book, it seems to me that what you got in Cyprus was very different to what you were told the situation was. Can you explain that for us?
Yes, to a certain extent I can explain it, though it is quite complicated. But in the Turkish Cypriot area where I was stationed, which was the Deliria area, Erenköy was one of, four, of the five villages on the coast.
That's the west coast, isn't it?
Yeah, it's north coast.
North coast.
And but in the western part of the country, that's true. The defenders of those five villages were approximately 300 farmers, the men and the boys grown up old enough to carry a weapon.
And you say defenders, so already they're under attack.
They were. I mean, they were surrounded by Greek Cypriots, civilians in the beginning, and later by Greek Cypriot troops. Those 300 were supported by Turkey, because Turkish Cypriot students who wanted to study after high school, wanted to go to university, they couldn't go to any Greek Cypriot university in Cyprus. They had to go to Turkey, which meant that most of them, about 500 of them, went to Turkey, to Ankara, to Istanbul, and some other places where there are universities. And those 500 out of how many, I don't know, volunteered for coming and trying to help their own people in their island. So they were shipped by Turkish Navy, by civilian fishing boats and motorboats and things like that, to Cyprus in spring of 1964. There were about 500 of them, and their military education was very close to none, because they had 2 or 3 weeks training, military training in Turkey. And in that time, you don't make a soldier. It takes a year or something like that to do it. So they were extremely inexperienced, but they were in the early 20s and they wanted to do something.
When you got to Cyprus, can you give us some idea, being a member of the UN forces there, what was the relationship between Greek Cypriots and the UN and Turkish Cypriots in the UN?
The relations between us and the two sides was a little different. The Turks were in minority all over the island. I mean, they were just one, let's say 25-30% of the population. The remaining were Greek Cypriots. The Greek Cypriots looked upon the Turks as invaders, even though they had been living there for centuries, at least their ancestors. So the relation between us and the Greek side was not as good as with the Turkish side, because the Turks looked upon us as savior of them, actually. I mean, we were trying, not only we, but all the others in the UN troops on the island, were trying to stop the fighting, to try to keep the Greek Cypriots away from Turkish areas, which they didn't succeed in all over. The relations were anyway better with the Turkish, mainly in most cases.
The UN was, am I correct to say, was supposed not to take sides, to be completely neutral.
Right.
But your book, chapter after chapter, you suggest this wasn't the case.
No. Obviously, very, very openly, the UN, we found that out during the time, that when we tried, and not just we, but my commander and other people who we knew, tried to stop the Greek attacks with violent methods or not, in both cases, the UN commanders stopped these actions. I can take an example. I was asked to come to one of the villages. There were five villages in Erinke area. One of them up in the mountains, which was under attack from the Greek side. Greek Cypriot National Guard soldiers and even Greek regular troops from motherland Greece, as they said. When I came there, my commander or my company, he said, I am trying to stop the Greeks attacking. I am trying to stop them from moving into the area. So these fields, there were fields surrounding two-thirds of the area. He said, I have prepared with the heavy mortar platoon we have, 120 millimeter mortars, quite heavy weapon. Yeah. It's a kind of artillery. I have prepared to fire open fire in front of the Greek forces. And we are going to tell them what will happen if they cross this line. Mm-hmm. So here is the map, he said. Take this map and go over to the Greek side and present the map and present our intentions within an hour. So I said, yes, sir, I will. And just when I was going to leave, came the Swedish battalion commander, the commander of the nearly 1,000 soldiers we had. He came from Nicosia. And he said, where are you going? What are you going to do? I'm going to tell them what we are going to open fire with heavy mortars if they cross this line. He said, no, we can't do anything like that. This is against our ideas. We are going to keep the peace. We are not going to kill people or threaten them. So you have to order this mission to be stopped immediately. My company commander, he said, yes, sir, we can't do anything if you don't give us the permission to use the force we have to stop this, because this is the last chance we have to stop the attack. So I never went over to the other side. I never presented them, and the mortar platoon got orders to stop preparing for the fighting.
So the Greek Cypriots effectively were allowed to attack eventually?
Yes. Because he said, okay, we can't help the Turks all the time. We can't be some kind of mission or nurses. We have to let them take care of this themselves, which is ridiculous, of course.
Your book contains many, many examples, and I don't want to go through them because I want people to read your book, because I think everyone needs to read it that has any interest in the recent history of Cyprus. So I want to fast forward, if I may, to when you decided to to help the Turkish Cypriots by risking your very freedom and trying to smuggle weapons to them. First of all, Willie, what made you do that?
I can say that this was an idea I got very early when I came to Cyprus. One of my commanders of the area who were before me in the Swedish Union, Swedish battalion, he said, you know, the Turks are in a very bad position. The Greeks are attacking them. They have very few weapons and so on. And they have very few equipments of any kind. So actually I promised to help them with bringing some tractor parts.
But tractor parts were actually
weapons.
Weapons.
They were machine guns. Oh. There were two or three machine guns.
That must have been unbelievably risky to you personally.
It was risky, but at least during those early days of the mission there, the Greeks didn't do anything. They didn't attack us. They didn't shoot at us. They didn't try to stop us. They were a little careful about making problems because they depended on the UN. So I heard about those things and I understand that it was going on. Some few people in the Swedish Union, as well as the other, tried to help the Turks and in different ways to stop the Greeks. Yeah. And how come that they had these weapons in Erenke? Because during the 5, 6, 7 months that they had been isolated from the rest of the island and surrounded by Greeks, they still had opportunity to bring in things from the sea. And because this was the only Turkish place, Turkish village, where they had access to the sea. And that's one of the reasons why the Greeks wanted to get rid of it, of course. So the Greeks said, oh, this is a place where Turkey would probably land troops. Anyone with the simplest knowledge of military, of arms, of weapons and of war could say this is totally impossible. This is the most stupid place in the whole island where you could try to land troops. There is one road going from here, a gravel road going along the coast, crossing dozens of rivers with bridges which could easily be blown up. There are high mountains, 2,500 meters high, close to the sea, where the defender, which means in this case the Greek Cypriots, could easily fire on Turkish units.
Odds were massively against the Turkish Cypriots.
Definitely.
And that's why you decided to help.
Yeah.
Now, I've got to ask this question. Should a soldier break the rules, if you like, should a soldier ever, under any circumstances, not do as he's told, which you did? Mm-hmm. You went against what you were told to do. Should a soldier ever be able to do that?
No. If you talk about it as a question, not as a fact, you would probably definitely say no. Mm-hmm. It is not right. You have to trust your soldiers, your officers and so on under your command, that they follow the orders they have. There are cases, I mean, in war, has been in the Second World War and in other wars, where situations have been so similar and or different in many ways that some people, some officers, some soldiers have gone against the orders they have. There have been Germans that saved Jews from going to the concentration camps. There have been prisoners of war that have been released and so on. And in some cases, I mean, from the First World War, we know that there was a ceasefire during Christmas and the soldiers went over to the other side and had a glass of beer, things like that. So it happens, and it is possible that under special circumstances, and this, to me, was a very special circumstance.
Sadly, you got caught.
Yeah.
at that time, and your book explains the lengths to which you tried to find out how you got caught.
Yeah.
At that time, did you regret your actions?
No.
If you could go through that all again, would you still do the same thing?
Yes, I would.
Now, tell us what happened when you got arrested. Tell me how you felt inside.
I didn't feel very much because we had been stopped before in Greek roadblocks. This was a roadblock outside a few kilometers before a village or a small city, we can call it, whose name is Lefke, where we had been before. We had transported weapons there before. We had escorted Turkish Cypriots from one village to another. We had been stopped in Greek roadblocks, where, by the way, we had orders to obey what the Greeks said. If the Greek Cypriots stopped a transport with Turkish Cypriots, we had to let them search the vehicles, so search the Turkish, not officially, to take over some of their equipment, their food or water or what it was. But it happened. But we have been superior, not in number, not in weapons, but we had an idea that we can always get through. They are not allowed to stop us, really. They can't stop us.
But they did. You were caught.
Yeah.
Briefly, tell us what happened to you.
We came, we had an armored car, which is actually an armored lorry.
Yeah.
It takes about 15 or 20 soldiers, and it has a few centimeters of armor around it, a double machine gun on the top. We were stopped in the roadblock, not in an ordinary place where we used to be stopped, but up in the mountains, in where there were no villages or no houses or no Turks at all. There just was a roadblock. The road was closed by oil barrels, lorries, a few armored cars, and on both sides of the road there were trenches where we saw soldiers with machine guns, bazookas, and our cars couldn't resist the bazooka fire or anything like that. So we actually, whatever we said, they didn't let us through. They said, stop, we want to search your vehicles. And I said, no, we are not going to let you search any vehicles. So we had to stay there for a couple of hours until finally the commander of the island, of the UN troops, a general from India, Mr. Timaya, by the way, came in helicopter. So did our Swedish battalion commander from Lefkosa. Before that, we didn't let any Greek enter any of our cars. Then we got orders, finally. The Greeks treated us politely and so on, so we can't complain. They didn't shoot at us or anything like that, as long as we didn't try to escape, of course. So finally, the commander said, open the cars. And they unloaded the weapons from these two armored cars. And on a field, quite a huge field beside, they filled it up with weapons and ammunition. And by pure coincidence, there were newspaper men, photographers, etc. there, lots of them, and they took pictures and filmed everything. So it was obviously well known what was going on. The Greeks had told them.
So what happened then? Because you were effectively taken back to Sweden and stood trial, is that correct?
Yes, but we were arrested on the fields here by a Swedish commander, battalion commander. We were transported in a Swedish car to the camp, a British soldier military camp in Nicosia, close to the airport, where we were reloaded and given two tents to live in, each of them. Just only the two officers over there. The soldiers were released after some inspection. And then we spent the following 4, 5, 6 days, I think it was, with interrogations by UN people, by Greek Cypriot soldiers, by Greek Cypriot police. When we didn't say anything because we said you have no right to ask us because you are not under your command. So after that, about a week, I think, a little more than a week, we were sent back to Sweden by Swedish Air Force.
And there you stood trial and you were eventually imprisoned.
Yes, we were put in prison directly when we came there. We were interrogated and we were in a trial in the local court, the district court.
And what was the charge?
The charge was illegal disobedience order, helping one side or things like that. I mean, I had an uncle with whom I have been living after my mother's death. His family, he was a high-ranking person in Justice Department. So he arranged for the best lawyer in Sweden. Actually, it was definitely. His name was Grünewald, the German name. And he was an effective defender. He said, I'm not going to... They are not going to give you lifetime prison as they want.
Were you worried about that at one stage?
No, not really. Okay. We had been under... The circumstances had been so tough in Cyprus. I mean, we had been under fire quite a few times. And we didn't expect any good treatment anywhere. So I was not really worried. A little to a certain extent, but very limited.
One thing that astonished me when you came back to Sweden was your countrymen and women and your country's media made you out to be almost, a latter-day Taliban member. The amount of vitriol and hate, and they also assumed that all Turkish Cypriots were terrorists.
Actually, you are quite right. I mean, we were looked upon as criminals.
How did that make you feel as a Swedish man?
I mean, Swedish people in general, they were informed by press, by the TV, etc. So they had no other option. There were a few people who understood what was going on. Some of them had been to the Cyprus forces before. They were, and some of my colleagues from the army and so on, because they understood that this is something very special. He wouldn't do this without a real reason, serious reason. But in general, I mean, everything was against us. And there were even articles in the newspapers that said the only thing that would be right in this case is to reinforce death penalty. Because this is the worst crime that has been committed in Swedish history since the murder of the king in the 17th, 18th century.
Wow.
So lifetime prison was they wanted us to have.
But you got 8 months in the end. You had a good lawyer and...
A very good lawyer.
How was the 8 months in jail?
It was interesting, we can say. It was, of course, a big difference to be together, to sit and eat lunch together with people who were murderers. Yeah. One of them had cut his victim into pieces and burned him up in the fireplace in his home. Some of them were rapists. Some of them they had killed people or beaten them up or done a lot of things. This was a prison for serious crimes.
And you were just trying to save the life of a few North Turkish Cypriots.
Yeah, but I was looked upon as a criminal, of course. That was the only... There was one newspaper, one of the bigger newspapers from Gothenburg, the second town in Sweden. They were a little more balanced. They said, we understand that this, why he did this, was that there must have been a reason, not just because he was making a crime. And though some authorities tried to make it a business, that I've been paid for it, they said, obviously, this is not true. He made it for other reasons.
Now, your book explains what happened after that. You went to live in Turkey. You even went back to Sweden. Yeah. But before we end this conversation, why did you come back to what is now North Cyprus, TRNC, where previously you would come across so much hate, so much negativity, so much danger? What was the attraction?
Well, I never came to Cyprus before the Turkish intervention, invasion, as the Greek called it, in 1974, which was 10 years after. I went to Turkey, as I said, and I got a lot of friends in Turkey. I got a lot of newspapers writing about it, and it was very positive treatment, even from the high authorities and so on. I heard about Cyprus, of course, but it was at that time impossible to go to Cyprus because it was under Greek Cypriot control. So after 74, it took another 25 years before I came to this part of the world. In the middle of the 90s, together with my wife, we went to Turkey and we also went to Cyprus. We were invited here by the then president, Rolf Denktash, to come here. We were given citizenships later. That made us, of course, to feel that this is home for us. Yeah. Here we are treated in a very positive way. Another thing that happened in Turkey when I was living there, I was living in Ankara, among other places, at the Cyprus Turkish students' home in Ankara and Istanbul as well. And one day I was working for a travel agency, and I spoke German, which was the main foreign language in Turkey at that time. So I was thinking of starting a travel agency, a small travel agency, just to make PR for my mission. And I talked to some people and they said, yes, no problem, but you have to pay an amount of money. I don't remember, was it £20,000 or something like that? It was quite a lot of money for me at that time. But they said, it's no problem. You can easily go to the Cyprus Turkish Students Federation, this Cyprus Turkish mission here. And they can, of course, give you the money for this. They can let you borrow the money. So I did so. I went there, prepared for a meeting, and I explained what it was about. And then they said, you need money? And yes, I said, I've never asked for any money from you before. But you got money. You got money from it was paid out to you. When and where, I said. Well, in Cyprus. Uh-huh. To whom did it wait? It was the captain. Oh, yes, I'm a captain. Then I started to remember a thing. When I was in Nicosia during the interrogations, then interrogations being led by the Greek Cypriot police, one of them had asked me, you have been to Morfu. Morfu is what they call Gizelio today. Mm. To the bank in Morfu. Have I? Yes, we know, because there was a man, an officer, he had a pistol hanging very low on his right leg, it's on Western, in Wild West style. I said, it's not me, I've never been there. I've never been in this area during my whole time here. Oh, you must have been. I said, okay, so I didn't think about it. It must have been something else. Then, when I came to Sweden, a man who had married a Turkish Cypriot woman, whom he had found in Nicosia, and he had married her. And he said, I'm going to marry her in a restaurant in Stockholm, in Sweden. But you are welcome to come and see her and me one day. So we went there, me and my colleague. Then I found out that this was the man they were talking about. this, he was a captain in the Swedish army. And he had been in Nicosia, he had been to Morfu, he had obviously been to the bank. And he had been paid, who is paying through a Greek bank? The Greeks. So we found out two things. One, he got money from the Turkish Cypriots for transporting, because he said, I am taking care of the transport. He joined us once. Secondly, he told them about the transport that we made the last time. And then he was paid by the Greek side. And so he got money from both sides. We didn't get anything and we didn't want anything. We never.
You didn't do it for money. You did it for purely humanitarian purposes.
Definitely not. I mean, this was a purely ideological thing. It was to help the poor people, which we really sympathized with. But the other side paid, and they also paid money to this man. So he got money from both sides. And this sounds ridiculous. How come? But we found out also, when we checked a little later, who is he really? He had been to the Congo. He had some kind of information officer job in the Congo. And when the Belgians that were left the Congo, when the war started, the Belgians, most of them left what they had there, houses, cars, furniture, and in some cases, money in the banks. Mm. Someone took care of this and made money of it. He sold cars to the Indian UN mission in Congo. The commander found this out and sent him home. Later, the same commander informed some people that I really tried to get rid of this man, but he applied to Cyprus and came with to Cyprus again as well. And he was the man. So it was in his way of living. Unfortunately, this is a bad story, but...
Needs to be told.
Yeah.
Recently here in the TRNC, we see the UN again taking sides by not allowing the Turkish Cypriots and their contractors to build a new road, whereas Greek side never have any problems doing that. Yeah. How does it make you feel, to end with? All you went through, nothing seems to have changed in all that time.
No, unfortunately, it is quite obvious that the UN is supporting the strong side here. What is the reason? Well, there can be many reasons. One of the reasons probably is Britain. Britain has two military bases on Greek Cypriot sides. As long as the Greeks and the Brits agree on things, nothing would happen with these bases. And that's why the Brits are probably supporting the Greeks more than they are supporting the Turkish side. In spite of 1955 to 59, with EOKA, the Greek resistance movement, or what we can call it, attacked Britain.
Yes.
And the British troops killed 461 soldiers and officers and hundreds and maybe thousands of civilians. They also forced the Greek Cypriots who were working for the Brits to leave their places, to leave their missions, which meant that the Turkish Cypriots were instead employed by the Brits. They took over the police and civilian missions, etc., in Cyprus. But in spite of this, probably because of the basis, they agree to 90% with the Greeks. Then we have, of course, I have been talking about this with the different organizations here, explaining a little about my history and Cyprus history. And I used to start asking them a question. How many Greek philosophers, scientists, mathematicians, and so on do you know? And they said, oh yes, Platon, Socrates, Archimedes, etc., etc. I can write them down, 10 of them. Okay. And now you tell me how many Turkish scientists, etc., you know. Wow. Are there any? No, nobody knows about them. What do you know about Turks? Where did they come from? Well, they came from Mongolia. They were riding horseback without saddles. And they had large swords or sabers, and they were sabers when they were cutting the heads of people as well. Turkey is not, doesn't look very cultural, very educated or developed compared to the Greeks. But this was 2,000, 3,000 years ago. Mm. Yes, but still, they still look upon the Greek side, not that they don't think so about it, but under the surface there is the thought here all the time that the Greeks are civilized people. Turks are okay. They occupied a lot of parts, and they killed a lot of people, and so on. So that the Greeks didn't kill anyone, of course.
Any hope for the future? For this island?
I don't know really, but now it is, next year is 75 years since Northern Cyprus, the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, was created. And there is a general rule that in politics, as far as I understand, that 50 years after something has happened like this, a border is drawn in a country and so on, there is a bigger chance that it will be accepted. But we don't trust this speculations, actually. Of course, the Greek Cypriot side must know now that Northern Cyprus would never disappear. And they would never accept being a part of the rest of Cyprus, where they would be treated in a bad way. I mean, what happened in the 1950s and 60s in Cyprus, 103 Turkish Cypriot villages were taken by the Greek side, destroyed. And I have seen 4 out of the 5 villages in the Erinköy area are now destroyed or taken over by the Greek side. And they are either disappearing by themselves or they are torn to pieces. So, of course, it would be nice to say, well, I hope they would be friends again. But not under the conditions they have now. If there are 2 countries, they could easily be friends. They could open the border, but they take care of themselves on each side of the border. And they would accept that. And that the problems would be solved for both sides. But unfortunately, this is not the case.
Willie Lind speaking to me from his lovely home near Lapta. And just wow, Sarah, wow. What an unbelievable story.
Absolutely. It really is. And yeah, I don't really know where to start. I mean, the fact that, you know, he felt the sympathy for the Turkish Cypriots, wanted to help, and then was just sort of vilified for it. I mean, incredible, you know, and looking possibly at a complete life sentence for doing what he did. I mean, that was incredible. I mean, thank goodness he had a good lawyer. And again, I don't want to say too much because people need to read the book, and I definitely need to get my hands on it. But from what he was saying there, I mean, he just sounds very sort of at peace with it a little bit, actually. I mean, the way he spoke, the way he talked to you, I mean, he's just like, well, that's what it was. I don't regret what I did. I'm here now. I'm enjoying life in the TRNC, and good on him. And I hope that everybody will buy the book, as you say, educate themselves about what's been happening.
Yes, it's really interesting also, Sarah, that although this book's only recently been published, it was actually written while he was in jail. Willie told me there's about 100 pages or so. He wrote that during his 8-month incarceration, which, of course, was very soon after it all happened. So he hasn't had to jog his memory to remember all these things. He wrote them down very soon after it all happened. And if you do want to buy the book, then Willie Lind is on Facebook. And very often in the Lapta area, he goes down maybe once a week to the Blue Song restaurant, where his book is for sale. It's 500 teller. It will cost you. But if you can't do that or it's not convenient, then just drop up in here at the podcast. Sarah will give you the details. We'll arrange for you to get the book because it is a must read. I think it's a must read for everyone that's remotely interested in the Cyprus problem.
Maybe we should try and hand it out to some politicians and some influential people as well, and maybe sort of get it to the south side. Who knows? But anyway, it's a sort of, as you say, it's the sort of thing that everybody needs to read just to get a bit of a broader perspective on the Cyprus problem. OK, well, as Roger said there, if you do want to get in touch with us, if you'd like a book, and we'll try and get one to you. But if you want to get in touch with us in any other way, we are on Facebook and Twitter, or whatever it's called now, X. I call it Twix now. So we just look for Talking Round North Cyprus. We have an email address as well, trnc.podcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening. I'm Sarah Palmer.
I'm Roger Barr. We'll talk to you again very, very soon.